one of the challenges we have in healthcare is actually humanizing healthcare. A lot of folks kind of view us as like this big business because we've got lots of bricks and mortar, lots of buildings. They hear that, you know, hospital executives are making high salaries. So I think one of our challenges to kind of improve that connection to community is humanizing the face of healthcare and moving it from being perceived as being about big business to, you know, really what the fundamental purpose of healthcare is, which is caring for people. I think, as you pointed out, the best way to develop that new brand for the field is to develop these intimate and really mutually supportive relationships.
Welcome to Difficult Conversations, Lessons I Learned as an ICU Physician with Dr. Anthony Orsini. Dr. Orsini is a practicing physician and president and CEO of the Orsini Way. As a frequent keynote speaker and author, Dr. Orsini has been training healthcare professionals and business leaders how to navigate through the most difficult dialogues. Each week, you will hear inspiring interviews with experts in their field who tell their story and provide practical advice on how to effectively communicate. Whether you are a doctor faced with giving a patient bad news, a business leader who wants to get the most out of his or her team members, or someone who just wants to learn to communicate better, this is the podcast for you.
Well, welcome to another episode of Difficult Conversations, Lessons I Learned as an ICU Physician. This is Dr. Anthony Orsini, and you guessed it, I'll be your host again this week. Today, I have the privilege and honor to have as my guest, Stephen Lawler. Steve has been the president of the North Carolina Healthcare Association since 2017. Prior to his current position, Steve served various roles for Vidant Health in Eastern North Carolina for over 20 years, including 7 years as the president of Greensville Hospital. From Vidant Health, he took the position as senior vice president, regional group of Carolina's healthcare system, until his current role as president of the North Carolina Healthcare Association. Well, welcome, Stephen. Really great to have you today. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to my audience.
Yeah, great to be part of this conversation.
You know, we had a really great conversation a week or two ago about the future of healthcare, and I think it's a really important and difficult conversation to have with all the politicizing of healthcare. And so I really just want to dive into this. And I don't think there's many more difficult conversations than when we talk about healthcare. So, but before we start, let's just start off as I usually do. Just tell the audience a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and how you got to be the president of the North Carolina Healthcare Association.
Well, so I grew up in North Carolina. I grew up in Eastern North Carolina, which typically is kind of a rural part of the state. So it's east of 95. So folks that have lived in Charlotte and Raleigh, they kind of thought it was like Columbus going off the side of the earth. Both my parents were educators. I grew up in a family that was committed to being part of some kind of business or industry that was based on service. So grew up there, went to college, the Citadel in Charleston, and then got into healthcare administration as an Army officer. So spent several years doing that, taught you a lot about leadership and teams and kind of selfless service and servant leadership. Got out, had an opportunity to come back to Greenville, where I grew up, and be part of that health system and that medical community, and did that for 22 years. I had the opportunity to do everything from running a critical access hospital to running a 1,000-bed teaching hospital, built a system, and retired from there. And I've had the opportunity to kind of reinvent myself in two different roles, and now have the great privilege of leading the North Carolina Healthcare Association, which supports all 130 hospitals in the state.
Did you always know you wanted to do something in healthcare, or did the universe just kind of take you there?
I think I always had an interest in healthcare. My mother was a public health nurse, and kind of like the old school public health nurse that had clients and people that she would go visit at their homes. And that was when population health was kind of something that they did versus a slogan. Yeah, so it had kind of the idea that's something that I was interested in. After a first semester of college chemistry, I realized that I may be better supporting those people that are taking care of people versus getting into the science of it. So just been really fortunate. You know, I've had a career where my purpose was to care for people that were caring for others.
That's great. And the North Carolina Healthcare Association, I think, represents 130 members. Can you tell us a little bit more about healthcare associations in general, but mostly North Carolina Healthcare Association and really what you do there for the people of North Carolina?
Well, I mean, healthcare associations really are a membership organization and with the sole purpose of supporting our membership. So much like other state associations, I mean, we do that on a variety of different fronts and with the focus of providing support and services to give our membership, which includes all kinds of hospitals, from state hospitals to private not-for-profits. We have for-profit systems in the state. We have governmental hospitals. So, I mean, our purpose is to provide programs and services to support them. So our sharp end really is about lobbying and advocacy and development of policy. We also spend a significant amount of time providing support structures for data and policy gathering, and then shaping that data and information in a way that allows our members to best continue to improve their practice, to improve quality of care, or it gives us a frame of reference when we are trying to shape policy or lobbying. We're now using that data and analytics to really take a deep dive and looking at equity of care and making sure that as we look at outcomes, we're not just looking at the end and declaring victory when our numbers are below the national average. We're really drilling down to fully understand what it means to different populations and then using that knowledge and understanding to shape better practice and processes and shape a way that we connect with community to really improve those outcomes. And then finally, we've got a shared services company that creates some economies of scale and buying power. So it's kind of like a brokerage portfolio that offers services to our members. And we've got one of the largest healthcare foundations in the country that does a variety of things from providing technical assistance to other community-based foundations to being a platform for granting for organizations that are community-based but have partnerships with hospitals and health systems to get at those issues that are either barriers to equity or that are creating disparities in care. So, you know, it's an incubator for good ideas. And I like to think about it as like this translational kind of research center that is focused on best ideas for practical solutions for better health within a community.
And for those people that are listening that aren't in healthcare, we know that it is so hard to do any research or quality improvement, especially if you're a smaller hospital, without some kind of partnerships with organizations. And to have all 130 of these hospitals kind of contributing and talking about their experience. And you mentioned inequities, and that's a hot topic right now. And so some of your hospitals, I'm sure, are in very rural areas, and some of them are in the city. And to be able to get those numbers and to not only look at the end, but to say, okay, what are we doing that's best practices is really extremely important if we're going to get any better. And I think healthcare right now, as far as quality of care, in my opinion, is going up and up, and we're getting better at what we do. My world is neonatology. And I remember as a medical student, which I don't want to tell you how long ago that was, but probably 30 years or whatever that was, telling me that a 28-weeker was the earliest survival of premature baby, and now we're saving 22-weekers. So that kind of a consortium is so important. You mentioned something earlier about helping with negotiating powers with insurance companies and costs. I went on the website of the North Carolina Healthcare Association, and I saw a little video explaining cost transparencies, which I think was the best explanation of how hospital costs occur and how we pay for healthcare in this country. And then during the Trump organization, transparency was a big topic. So tell me how we are in a crisis right now with healthcare. We're trying to get better and better care, but it's getting more and more expensive. There's those people who have made healthcare into a political push. Where do you see healthcare going with universal healthcare versus private? And what can we do to kind of make the numbers work better and still keep that quality of care?
First of all, I think if I were a young man or woman that was interested in a career, I can't think of a more exciting time to get into healthcare. And it's a challenging time, as you point out. I mean, healthcare is expensive, and it's driven by just these amazing discoveries in clinical advances. It's driven by new technologies that help support that clinical advances, and it does driven by pharmaceutical prices, which are double the healthcare rate of inflation. So the fact is that we need to work together to make healthcare more affordable and less expensive. And I think that's a fact. The idea of transparency, I think, is really important and something that we certainly embrace, and it should go hand in hand with decisions that patients and families make in regards to where they get their care. And then I think even more importantly, what their plan of care looks like. And we talked a little earlier about the importance of conversation between patients and families and the provider community. Well, I think that becomes even more important as we talk about kind of quality outcomes and affordability, because there's a lot of things that we can do for people. I think one of the tough questions, and you're an intensivist, so you can appreciate this, what's the right thing to do to maximize quality of life for individuals? So the things that we're working on for the future of healthcare in North Carolina is we're looking at value-based care and an alternative payment models, which actually return economic value to the place within the system of care that has the greatest potential to improve health and reduce costs. So that's kind of thinking outside the four walls of a hospital and looking at how do we make investments with relationships and partnerships throughout the community, be it primary care, the faith community, or just community partners to better engage patients in their care early on so that we are not left with a healthcare system that is only focused on sick care, that only focuses on what happens when that patient becomes in distress, shows up at the ED. So I think it's really about thinking about where we're making investments in the future. It's pushing managed care companies, and managed care companies have done very well claiming to be the solution for patients and families. And the fact is they do play an important role, but they play an important role as a middleman in the process. They play an important role from a finance and administration perspective, but they're not the ones that are driving kind of what happens to that patient. So I think the future of healthcare really is about physicians and hospitals and health systems and other partners that are touching and creating value for patients, kind of taking their rightful spot as the trusted advocate for patients and families and replacing the managed care companies who have worked hard through marketing and other approaches to kind of fill that gap. So I think those things are really important. And I do think that anytime a physician in a hospital can provide the total experience of care for that patient, family, or community, which means that not only they're providing clinical care, but they're also providing the full complement of support structures that typically may be available through a managed care company. Anytime we can build that ourselves and offer that to the community, I think what we'll find are, you know, communities will have better outcomes and care will be cheaper.
Yeah, you mentioned some really key words there, trust, relationship, and cost. And I think they're so related to each other. One is getting your routine care, getting your routine checkups. It always shocks me that everyone knows that if you take your car to get its oil changed every 5,000 miles, you're less likely to break down.
Yep.
But we don't do that for ourselves, right? We don't go for our colonoscopies. But there's a lot of data that says that most people don't do that, maybe because they don't have the relationship with either their doctor or their community hospital, and or there's a relationship there just because they're local, but there's really no trust in the system. I think one of the best things that happened in healthcare is in the last 10 years is the elevation of the patient experience. And more than ever, the experience that a patient has, we know, improves outcomes, and they're more likely to go for their health care visits. And so I think that's one of the best things that we have done. But I think we do have to form those relationships with the community, as you said. And how are we doing with that? Because I really need to teach these community hospitals better on how do you make those relationships so that people come in for their routine visits.
I mean, if you look at polling data from national firms, nurses and doctors are the most trusted professionals. So I do think that understanding and leveraging individual relationships or people's perception of groups of people is really important. And I do think that one of the challenges we have in healthcare is actually humanizing healthcare. A lot of folks kind of view us as like this big business because we've got lots of bricks and mortar, lots of buildings. I mean, they hear that hospital executives are making high salaries. So I think one of our challenges to kind of improve that connection to community is humanizing the face of healthcare and moving it from being perceived as being about big business to really what the fundamental purpose of healthcare is, which is caring for people. And I think, as you pointed out, the best way to develop that new brand for the field is to develop these intimate and really mutually supportive relationships with key community partners that look like and that have close connections with the people that we're so privileged to take care of. And having been a hospital administrator and a healthcare executive for 40 years, I can tell you that we're great at fixing problems. We're not great at listening. So I think listening to these community leaders and really understand what's the solution to the issues that are either barriers to care, what are the solutions to issues that cause readmissions to hospitals because people may not have the right support structure when they discharge, what are the barriers from creating access? We can come up with solutions all day to the problem that we think are going to work, but really listening and developing these kind of intimate relationships and then being courageous enough to ask people for help that may not be as large and complex and sophisticated as you are, well, that's the solution. And I'm excited to see those conversations start to happen. But again, we're in a business of problem solving. I mean, you're, as a physician, I mean, you're perfectly trained to diagnose and solve a problem. We're perfectly trained to kind of say, okay, I've got all these resources. Let's apply them to make things better. But, you know, having fumbled in that kind of communication, and thankfully I had a minister that was kind enough to point out where I was missing the boat and helped me kind of connect in a more meaningful way to get stuff done, I think that's a critical aspect for making progress in the future.
Tell me about that conversation. The minister sit you down and say, Steve, you're getting this all wrong. How'd that go?
When I was the CEO of a 1,000-bed teaching hospital, I mean, once a month I had like this ecumenical lunch. So I got all the faith community members together and we break bread and it was I thought it was like fantastic. It was marvelous. And I'd give them updates on everything that we were doing and here's what's new about the medical center. And here's all the things we're doing to fix all the community woes. And after about, you know, 3 or 4 months of this, one of the most influential African-American pastors sat me down and said, hey, Steve, he said, you have a second. So after everyone left, we sat down and we're drinking our iced tea. And he said, this is a complete waste of time and you're not getting anything done. And I was like shocked. And he said, we appreciate your effort to get us together. And by the way, it's a great lunch. He said, but you're missing the point. We're not here to listen to you tell us how to solve our problems. We're here because we want a relationship. We want you to listen to us so we can help you understand what the barriers are. And then we can help give you the fill in the blank answers to get this right for our community. So I was just grateful that he thought enough of me to sit me down and tell me I was getting it wrong.
I love that. That's a great story. It's all about relationships. And to me, you know, what we do at the Orsini Way, we train doctors on how to form relationships with patients. And then that just moves up. In my mind, this is an upside down pyramid. So we always say a patient can have a relationship with a person. It's hard that you can have an abstract relationship with a community or a hospital, but there has to be this upside down pyramid where the patient feels a strong, trusting relationship with their family doc, who's on the ground, who they have a relationship with. And then when their family doctor says, this is the test that I think you should have, they go for that test. And that's been shown over and over again, that if you trust your doctor, you're going to do it. And then when the family doctor says, I need to bring it to the hospital, and this is where you should have it done. And so we just get wider and wider. But without that one-on-one community doctor, and I think, and I'd like you to comment on this, I think part of the problem is the community doctors don't have enough time because of the restraints put on them to sit and really talk to their patients. Or maybe the community doctor going to the local church and saying, this is why you need to have your colonoscopy. That's what I'd like you to comment on, the restraints on that community doctor to really take the time for those relationships.
Yeah, so I think that's a great comment. So I think, I mean, for no better term, it's about how we value time and how we assign some kind of financial support or payment for that time. So I do think moving to some kind of universal payment or some global payment or even a capitated rate where clinically integrated networks are responsible for a population and they're paid for that population, I think that creates the kind of dynamic that allows that community physician, that primary care physician, to invest more time in conversation and understanding so they can customize that plan for patients. Because right now, I mean, their time is so fashioned toward productivity that it doesn't incent that. And I think once you become responsible for the health of a community, you're investing your time differently. You're using your healthcare team differently. I mean, right now, most primary care physicians have a patient panel between 2,000 and 3,000. I think that's kind of how they view. When I used to be a practice manager, I think that was our target. But what would happen if your practice had 10,000 people and you had advanced level practitioners that were taking care of those things that were reasonable for a nurse practitioner or a PA or even a health educator? And the physician's time was really dedicated to, you know, helping customize those plans for people that really needed care. So I do think when we look at value-based care or alternative payment models, part of the long-term goal is to use talented people at the point that they're most effective. And boy, if we can get our primary care physicians to really understand how to customize care plans that are easy for people to follow, and that enable individual patients to get it right. I mean, it's kind of like coaching individuals. Some people, you can give them the plan, they're out the door and they're doing great. Other people just need, you know, some additional support and rehearsals to kind of go through it over and over again before they get it right. So for those of us who have had the privilege of like coaching our kids in sports, which is kind of like a thankless job because I mean, every other parent thinks they're smarter than you are and they're quick to tell you, but you know, you've got kids with different levels of ability. So and patients are very much the same way. Some get it immediately, they're out the door. Others just need some additional support. So wouldn't it be great if those primary care physicians had the time to provide that additional support and coaching?
Yeah, I just gave a TED talk that dropped last week about personalizing medicine. And I think that's one of the things that is one of the biggest struggles with medicine right now, with electronic medical records and all the documentation and all the billing. I've had doctors come to me and say, I just don't understand. I have really a good doctor. I do practice really well, but my practice is not thriving. I'm not getting those 2,000 or 3,000. And mostly it's not their abilities as a physician or a scientist. It's just, we need to train them a little bit more on how to form that relationship with a patient when they walk into the room. How do you find that commonality? How do you become, as my mother would say, the best friend? Walk in and Dr. Lawler is my best friend and I really see him not just as a doctor, but as a person, et cetera. And so making that personalization of medicine from the doctor and then it goes right up to the community hospital is really so important. But I don't think we give enough protected time for that kind of, and I hate this term, but it's still being used, soft training for physicians and for health. It's soft training. It's not soft training. It's actually required training.
Well, I'm going to be interested to see, having been the CEO of a big teaching hospital that was a partner with a medical school and we had 400 residents and fellows, I'm going to be interested to see how our next generation of physicians, and these are young people that are extraordinarily skilled in social media and communicating that way, how they transition into a profession that really is based on like personal conversations and personal connections. They're going to be taking care of people that have never texted before. You know, my parents can't use an ATM machine, for God's sake. That's going to be a new skill set that we're going to be asking folks in medical school and residency to grasp and understand pretty quickly. And I mean, how do you deal with conflict with a group of people that like text each other, well, you're mean to me, and versus kind of, I mean, how do you have these like really tough conversations? So I'm going to be really excited and interested to see how we help prepare those young men or women, because it is going to be different.
It's a great point. Right now, this is a generation that's growing up with instant information. And whatever disease your doctor mentions, they can look it up. And so the doctor-patient relationship is less informational. And 20 years ago, the doctor would explain everything that's going on, and that was their main goal of that conversation. And now I'm teaching the young people that your main goal is not necessarily information. You do have to provide that, but it's really relationship. And so one of the exercises we do is I take a doctor and I'll say, okay, I want you to speak to somebody here and tell them the diagnosis and then explain what it is. Okay. And I want you to watch their eyes. Now tell them what it is first and then say, we call that, and I'll write it down for you. And what happens, Steve, is it's 9 out of 10 times, if I give you a diagnosis, hyperemesis gravidarum, the patient looks up and starts to figure out what, how to spell it.
That's like a really complicated name. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Right. So whatever it is, it could be ulcerative colitis, but what they're doing is almost universally, especially the young people, they're trying to remember how to spell it, because as soon as they get home, they're going to Google it. That's just a fact. You and I never did that when we were younger. So by you telling them, and these are simple things that we teach, this is what it is. This is what we call it. And I'll write it down for you as soon as we're getting ready to leave. What happens? Your attention snaps right back on me. And now we're listening. And so little things like that. Yeah, I mean, just little things that we can do to teach. Because right now, you're right. I have 3 kids. My youngest one's 21. My oldest one's 28. And they totally text. And this is the way they communicate. And I work with them all the time just because that's what I do. But many of these kids can't communicate. And sometimes we're having a conversation and my youngest one will just start going on his phone. And I used to get really angry with him. I'm like, TJ, his name is, like, what are you doing? Like, I'm speaking to you. And Lauren, my wife, says, he's looking it up. So that's what that generation is doing. So if I say, give my son advice, even from his father, he's looking it up as we speak to see if I'm right.
Yeah. No, if you ask your kids, I mean, I've done this. Hey, when's the last time you talked? I've got 2 kids and they're amazing. And thank God they took after their mother. But it's when's the last time you talked to your brother? And they don't talk on the phone. They're just like communicating back and forth in a different way. So but there's a lot we can learn from this younger generation. And I can tell you, anytime we had an issue with our electronic medical record, I had an advisory group of residents. I just like turned them loose on that. And said, hey, here's a problem that like some of the older faculty are dealing with. And I mean, they come up with a solution in like a matter of hours on how to make something easier. So that's pretty exciting, I think. But I do think, getting to an earlier point in our conversation, making it all personal, even though we've got all these amazing tools and technology, it's really about relationships. And it's about just having that personal connection. That's the currency. I mean, relationships are the currency we use to get anything done.
And it ties into everything that we do, both in our personal and professional life. But as far as medicine, if you have a relationship with your doctor, you're less likely to file for a malpractice lawsuit.
Yeah.
If you have a relationship with your doctor, you're more likely to listen and take your medication and you'll have better outcomes. One of the things that I'm hoping that we're going in the right direction and the patient experience is pointing us that way is let's teach our healthcare professionals how to have those relationships, and then we'll go on. So one more question before I get to the final question. So if you take out your little crystal ball, now you've been in healthcare for all these years, 10 years from now, where do you think we'll be?
So I think 10 years from now, I think we'll be more clinically integrated. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's like a balance sheet exercise where people are taking care over other people. I think it means that we've been smart enough and wise enough to figure out if we're all responsible for the health of a geography or health of a state or even the health of a region, figuring out how to leverage the best ideas and the best locations and kind of bringing that into a package to make it easier for patients and communities to receive the best care at the right location, right time, and navigate that care. So I think we'll see that. And I think that's pretty exciting. I think we'll see those clinically integrated networks move to provide coverage options for people in geographies. I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think it creates some efficiencies for the system. I think we'll see, you know, more advances and movement toward kind of hospital at home and kind of using technologies where patients and families have more control over where they're getting care, and then being closer partners in how that care is managed and delivered. And then finally, I think we'll continue to see improvements in quality and patient outcomes and patient safety. And tied to that, I think we'll see advances in equity and reducing disparities, because I do think that by following the same game plan that we followed after Don Berwick's 100,000 Lives campaign kickoff, where we took this very focused and systematic approach to reducing events with harm, I think following that same game plan for equity and disparities, we're going to see significant progress over the next 10 years. So I'd like to think that at least in North Carolina, and I'm sure other states would say the same, that our health outcomes and kind of rankings as a state on how healthy we are going to improve. And when we focus on that, it's kind of like the rising tide. It's going to, you know, lift all boats. And then finally, I just like to, you know, see our hospitals and health systems continue to build on that level of trust and confidence that we have coming out of the pandemic. That's something that has been a good thing, where people realize we're this like amazing force for good. Sometimes we're not at our very best talking about that, but I think we've proven that over the past 18 months. So I think building on that really is important. And part of that, I think, ties back to humanizing healthcare.
One of the few things that did come out of COVID, I agree, is this Healthcare Heroes campaign that came out from COVID, showing how hard doctors and nurses really are working and work for your health. And I do think that it did form more trust with the healthcare system. Prior to that, because of either political or media reasons, we were starting to paint physicians and hospitals, as you said early on, as people and organizations who are just looking to make loads and loads of money to buy the Jaguar. But then we saw nurses on the floor sleeping in the hallway during COVID and caring for patients. And I think that humanized it. So I'm pretty optimistic about where medicine is going. And I think we are definitely getting better with the quality. We're getting better with safety. But the only caution is that we have to make sure that we are keeping the personalization, especially with, I mean, we're using electronic medical records to maximize billing and to maximize safety. But I had one doctor say to me last month, you know, I feel like I'm treating the computer and I'm not treating the patient. And so as long as we're careful about that, I think I agree, things are going in the right direction. So Steve, I'm not sure if I warned you about this question when we spoke or not. This is the last question I ask every guest before we leave. What, in your 20 plus years experience in healthcare or in your personal life, what do you think is the most difficult conversation you have had to have, type of conversation? And please give the audience some advice on how to navigate through that type of conversation.
I would say the most difficult conversation I've had has been with my aging parents. For all of the wonderful things we have in healthcare, it's hard to navigate. And for helping an aging population develop a plan for themselves for the future, boy, that was a really hard conversation when we sat down with our folks and said, let's talk about kind of how do we create the conditions for you to meet objectives that you both have. So it was really, I mean, and I think these are probably conversations that are going on all over the country. And part of it is the difficulty, and you've seen this, in having critical conversations with families about a critically ill grandfather in the hospital that is not going to be able to leave that hospital and do all the wonderful things that individual loved doing. So for my folks, it was really sitting down and saying, what's important to you in this kind of last chapter of your life? And it was being together. So I was happy about that. And they've been married for 60 something years. And I said, okay,
wow.
In order to do that, if you want to be together, you're going to have to change. And some of the things that you hold dear we're going to have to work with you to change so you can meet your objective. And that was a tough conversation because it required some decision-making and support they didn't necessarily want if they were orchestrating the plan by themselves. And it taught me a lot about just, you know, how to kind of, in a very respectful and caring way, have a conversation that leads people to where they want to be and then work backward from there to make it work for them.
I think that's great advice. And the way to navigate those is to let them make the decision on their own, kind of lead them where you want to go. But I think all too often we tend to dictate these difficult conversations like, mom and dad, this is what has to happen, or this is what you need to do. And I think it works best if they can make that decision on their own. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I would completely agree.
Well, that's great advice. Steve, thank you so much for taking the time. You're crazy busy, I know. And thank you so much for your time, for what you do, for promoting healthcare. And thank you for my audience, because I think they really learned a lot from you today. And it was a great conversation.
Hey, thanks. And I really appreciate you doing this, because, I mean, it's a great venue for, you know, people to be up to date in regards to what's going on, but also it kind of lifts the shroud of secrecy sometimes in regards to what actually takes place versus what people think.
That's what we hope to do. Steve, the best way for someone to get in touch with you if they're listening to this?
They can email me, slawler@ncha.org.
And we'll put that in the show notes. If you enjoyed this conversation, if you joined this episode, please go ahead and hit follow on your favorite podcast. If you'd like to get in touch with me, I'm available at theorsiniway.com. Steve, again, thank you so much.
Take care. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please hit the subscribe button and leave a comment and review. To contact Dr. Orsini and his team, or to suggest guests for future podcasts, visit us at theorsiniway.com.
The comments and opinions of the interviewer and guests on this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the opinions and beliefs of their present and past employers or institutions.